Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, dies at 76. You have a shine. Use your shine to spread light in a place of darkness. That's a paraphrase from her. That's how she lived her life. Aretha Franklin, universally recognized as the Queen of Soul and one of the greatest American voices in any genre, died this morning in Detroit. She was 76. She sang at a time when the clarity of her voice was needed, and she had one of the clearest and most soul-piercing voices ever. I mean, bone marrow piercing. She was part of the cadre of celebrities along with Harry Belafonte and Dick Gregory, whose performances in the 60s supported Dr. King and the SCLC. Singing Respect in 1967 and To Be Young, Gifted, and Black in 1970 were very important statements, not just for women, but for people of color all around the world. She refused to compromise. She never changed to meet the American aesthetic. She was truly our Queen of Soul. R.I.P. Rest in peace, Aretha Louise Franklin. U.S. newspapers attack Donald Trump's dirty war on the so-called free press with coordinated editorials. Over 350 U.S. newspapers devoted print space today to a coordinated defense of a so-called press freedom and a rebuke of President Donald Trump for saying some media organizations are enemies of the American people. The Globe's editorial accused Trump of carrying out a sustained assault on the free press. Quote, the greatness of America is dependent on the role of a free press to speak the truth to the powerful, the Globe's editorial said. Quote, to label the press the enemy of the people is as un-American as it is dangerous to the civic compact we have shared for more than two centuries, end quote. America is blessed with a First Amendment, and it's imperative that the American press not be the voice of corporate and militaristic interests. The consolidation of American media assets by Sinclair Broadcasting and others is damaging democracy, not enhancing it. So kudos to the 350 newspapers who coordinated in defense of press freedom. Now I say to them, go out there and do your job, covering the real issues of the world, disseminating real information and analysis that enables your listeners and readers to make informed decisions, not be distracted by foolishness and the standard corporate narrative. Mike Pence fires warning shots to Turkey as Qatar vows $15 billion worth of support. Mike Pence, the U.S. vice president, has warned Turkey not to test America's resolve in an escalating row between two countries. Pence said Andrew Brunson, an evangelical pastor whose detention in Turkey has triggered tit-for-tat sanctions between the two NATO allies, must be released immediately and hinted at further punitive steps if he was not allowed to go free. This while Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, Qatar's emir, arrived in the Turkish capital, Ankara, and Qatar's royal court has announced that Al Thani issued directives that will see the state of Qatar to provide a host of economic options, projects, investments, and deposits worth $15 billion to support the Turkish economy. So the plot thickens. As some thought Turkey would sell itself cheap for Chinese money or Turkey would collapse under the weight of the U.S. pressure, Qatar enters the picture, providing Turkey a third way forward by strengthening even further Turkey's strategic autonomy and optimally exploiting its foreign policy options. This is in no way checkmate for Turkey, but it does provide President Erdogan some breathing room. Manafort jury to begin deliberations. The jury in Alexandria, Virginia, began deliberating Paul Manafort's guilt or innocence to bank and tax fraud charges today. Jurors heard closing arguments yesterday. Lawyers for the former Trump campaign chief argued in their closing remarks that the prosecution wouldn't have a case without its star witness, former Manafort associate Rick Gates. Gates testified that he committed crimes with Manafort and that he stole from his boss. The defense argued that Gates lied. Manafort is facing more than a dozen charges of fraud and money laundering. I think he's facing 18. We'll see how this all plays out. Lockheed Martin awarded over $3 billion in government contracts in just 2 days as military frets about Russian and Chinese alleged advances. According to Whitney Webb from Mint Press, the U.S. Air Force announced within the span of 2 days earlier this week that it had awarded over $3.3 billion in contracts to U.S. weapons giant Lockheed Martin. The first of these contracts, totaling $480 million, was announced on Monday and tasked Lockheed with designing a new hypersonic missile. The new missile, known as the Air-Launched Rapid Response Weapon, is the second hypersonic missile ever developed at Lockheed, as the U.S. Air Force awarded a $928 million contract to the company in April to develop the hypersonic conventional strike weapon program. The second contract, totaled a sizable $2.9 billion, was awarded to Lockheed earlier and tasks the company with creating three missile warning satellites, with each satellite set to cost just under $1 billion each. What grave threat has prompted the U.S. military to spend over $3 billion on new missiles in just 4 months? According to military officials, the answer is Russia and China. As statements made earlier this year by Air Force officials clearly show, that the new missiles developed by Russia and China are significantly superior to those currently used by the U.S. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Aretha Franklin, universally recognized as the Queen of Soul and one of America's greatest singers in any genre, died this morning in Detroit. She was 76. She sang at a time when the clarity of her voice was needed, and she had one of the clearest and most soul-piercing voices ever. To get some insight into what she meant on a cultural level, we turn to my first guests. My first guest has just finished a manuscript for the forthcoming book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. One of the most prolific writers of our time, historian Dr. Gerald Horn. As always, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're also joined by Reverend Dr. Keith William Byrd, Sr., pastor at the historic Zion Baptist Church in Northwest Washington, D.C. Dr. Byrd, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you so much for having me on as well.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Dr. Horn, we know about Aretha Franklin as a singer and a pianist. As I said in the opening, one of America's greatest singers in any genre, but many don't know about her as a participant and supporter of the civil rights movement. Your thoughts on the passing of Aretha Franklin?
Well, as they say in the South, she got it honest. That is to say, her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, was a comrade and friend of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King spent time at their home in Detroit, Michigan. Aretha Franklin herself worked with Harry Belafonte and other artists in terms of raising funds for the civil rights movement. As well, I think it's important to note how she was shaped by those who were passing through her Detroit home. She's mentioned Art Tatum, the great Toledo-born pianist, who may have been the greatest master on the 88th and the keyboard that has been known to human being to this point. She also knew well Oscar Peterson, born in Canada, and another great keyboardist himself. So Aretha Franklin leaves a great vacuum with her passing.
Reverend Byrd, you are well-versed in her background as well as the background of her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, his relationship with Dr. King. In a cultural context, your thoughts on the passing of Aretha Franklin.
Thank you very much. And I just want to piggyback on what your previous guest has just said, that Aretha Franklin her passing leaves a tremendous void, particularly when you start talking from a cultural perspective. At least several generations have been impacted by her voice. And when I say her voice, not just her musical gift, but her voice in terms of her cultural affirming sense and persona. Aretha Franklin was the standard bearer for our culture. It was James Brown who said, "I'm black, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud." But Aretha embodied being black and being proud wherever she was. She represented the very best, not only of black people and black culture, but she represented the very best of the black church and what the black church meant in terms of affirming people and their social living and their aspects of their social living. So she leaves a tremendous void. She was an embodiment of soul, not just as a genre of music, but she was an embodiment of what it meant to be a person of feeling authentically. God created, God gifted, and God blessed. And we're going to truly miss her.
Dr. Horn, following up on that point, one of the things that I said in the opening was she refused to conform to the American aesthetic. She was a beautiful, beautiful woman, and she was very comfortable in who she was, how she looked, her natural hair. She wore dashikis in the 60s. She was just a gorgeous, natural black woman.
And I think that the point you're making particularly comes clear in the 1960s when she signs with Atlantic Records. Recall that Atlantic Records is not an unfamiliar label to those of you in Washington, D.C. It was initiated by Ahmet Ertegun, who was the son of a Turkish diplomat who came to appreciate black music. And in fact, during the era of Jim Crow in Washington, used to invite the black musicians to the Turkish embassy in Washington to play. From there, he migrated into forming Atlantic Records, and one of his great coups was the signing of Aretha Franklin. And what's striking is that after she signed with Atlantic Records, that's when you began to see her being transformed from what her previous label was trying to make her.
Columbia.
Exactly. Her previous label was trying to make her into a kind of Ebony Barbara Streisand, if you like. Whereas after signing with Atlantic Records, that's when you began to see this torrent of hits, including the signature hit Respect, for example. And that raises another question. That is to say, Aretha Franklin had this remarkable gift in terms of taking songs that were ostensibly about what we are used to hearing about, which is relationships between men and women, for example, and heterosexual relationships. But because of the times, Respect turns into an anthem for black America. Just like some of her songs.
Think is another one.
For example, it turns into a kind of not only a song for black America, but a kind of feminist anthem, and the same for Natural Woman as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this raises another point, which is that she was not only a great person, but as so often happens, this great person was shaped by the greatness and the turbulence of the time.
Reverend Byrd, when I think about Aretha Franklin and her refusing to compromise to fit the American aesthetic, it made me also think about Nina Simone, African-American female pianist who was very comfortable in her natural beauty and refused to compromise.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up. Aretha Franklin had in her contracts, long before many of the other black artists had in their contracts, that she would not perform for segregated audiences. Aretha Franklin had in her contracts up until her last show that she had to be paid up front and in cash, because many black artists who came along during her time were often stiffed by the promoters. But Aretha Franklin insisted on doing things in a way that she felt comfortable with, and she broke many of those norms. She just was the bomb. Aretha Franklin, and let me just say this one other thing in terms of her cultural persona. Aretha Franklin brought black sexuality to a new point, particularly for black women. She made it known that black women were sensual and sexual and not just objects of people's desires, particularly the white people, that black women had class and pizzazz and were sexy and were no nonsense. And so in a real sense, Aretha has been carrying the feminist movement on her shoulders for decades. And I don't think she gets enough credit for doing that.
Dr. Horn, you finished a manuscript for the forthcoming book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. Many don't know. Well, you mentioned Art Tatum. You mentioned Oscar Peterson, people who greatly influenced her, and she's an incredibly underrated pianist. But many people don't know that earlier in her career, she performed at a number of jazz clubs. She performed in New York with Coltrane at the Village Vanguard. She also performed at the Village Gate. So again, from a cultural perspective and your research in Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of Music, your thoughts on Aretha Franklin from that context?
Well, in that context, we should not give short shrift to the city of Detroit. I don't find it coincidental that Aretha Franklin, even though she was born in Memphis, another city of great black music, which helped to produce Stax Records.
Stax Records.
But she spent most of her life living in Detroit, the city that helped to produce Motown. She grew up around the corner from Smokey Robinson of the Miracles. Detroit has been a fantastic jazz town, as you know, helping to give birth to Kenny Burrell, the guitarist, Curtis Fuller, the trombonist, Ron Carter, the bassist, Regina Carter, the violinist. And in that sense, it's not coincidental that this great black star who is now fallen, speaking of Aretha Franklin, grew up in the Motor City, which has made its mark by helping to produce a stellar cast of black musicians.
It's also interesting that it wasn't until she, I think it was in Memphis where she went back after she got to Atlantic Records and she recorded with the Muscle Shoals rhythm section that we really got the real depth of who Aretha Franklin is relative to her music, and particularly in terms of her blues sound. So, Reverend Byrd, in closing, your thoughts in terms of your understanding of her history, and again, if you could, please talk a little bit more about her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, before we get out of here. If you could please spread a little more light about her father, the history of her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin.
Certainly, I would be glad to do that. Reverend Clarence LaVon Franklin was her dad. He was a famous preacher, not just in Detroit, but across the country. Dr. Franklin was one of the first African-American pastors to have his own radio show, and many of his sermons were reproduced and sold. He was a tremendous, tremendous preacher and orator, and Aretha, quite frankly, got her start by singing at the church and opening up, doing her father's revivals and those kinds of things, as well as you got to put the influence of Clara Ward, the Clara Ward singers. All of these people would be brought to Detroit to sing at New Bethel Missionary Baptist Church with Dr. Franklin, and Aretha was exposed to all of these people, including Mahalia Jackson, who was great friends with Dr. Franklin. And so much of her culture stems from the music and the sounds and the singing groups and the quartets that she heard in the church. And I'd like to close my words out by talking about Aretha Franklin's faith. She was and is a woman of faith. And all that she was, all of the connections that she had, were spiritual connections that were deeply rooted in her faith in Jesus Christ. And I think anybody who knows anything about Aretha Franklin must know that she was faith first, and everything else she did, the base, the foundation for her singing and her career was certainly her faith. And that is what sustained her across all the decades that she was able to perform. And that's why, even though we mourn her passing, we know exactly where she is.
Dr. Horn, she was multi-generational. It wasn't odd to go to an Aretha Franklin concert and see three generations of a family. Her music just transcended genre. Her music transcended generation. But her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, to everything that Reverend Dr. Byrd just mentioned, he was also an incredible organizer. And so there was a march in Detroit that preceded the March on Washington.
Once again, I don't think you can begin to understand the trajectory of Aretha Franklin's life and career without understanding the city of Detroit. Not only this is a city of a vibrant Black liberation movement, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, for example, comes out of Detroit. The United Auto Workers, particularly during its militant phase in the 1930s, obviously comes out of Detroit. And as you correctly note, months before the more celebrated March on Washington in August 1963 in Washington, D.C., there had been a like-minded march in Detroit of similar caliber, where, quite frankly, Dr. King tried out some of the themes that then catapulted him into fame and notoriety in Washington, D.C. a few months later. This is the environment that helped to produce and create Aretha Franklin. And once again, I think it's important to point out that it's not only the person who shapes the times, it's the times that shape the person.
And I'll close with this, because Dr. Horn, I'm glad you made that point. I'll go to Reverend Dr. Byrd first, and then I'll come back to you, Gerald, for this final point. What gets lost, whether we're talking about the music, whether we're talking about the history of the revolution, whether we're talking about people, they don't understand the lineage from whence things are born and built upon. So as we look at the March on Washington, we don't know that it was Aretha Franklin's dad months earlier that had created the basis for that in Detroit. We lose track of the lineage in the history from whence things are birthed and built upon. Again, Reverend Dr. Byrd, final point to you, sir.
Absolutely. And I don't think enough can be said about how Aretha Franklin, learning from her father, Dr. C.L. Franklin, the importance of using your celebrity to improve the conditions of your people and their living situation. And Dr. Franklin did it oftentimes, not just that week before the march, but oftentimes when the movement needed money, Dr. King and others would make their way to Detroit, and they knew they could always count on some financial backing from Dr. Franklin.
And Aretha performed many concerts in order to raise money for the movement. And again, to you, and then we got to get out, Dr. Horn, the point about, as a historian, you know better than most, understanding the history and the lineage from whence things are birthed and built upon.
Well, absolutely. As the saying goes, human beings make their own history, but they have to make it with the cloth at hand. And the cloth at hand was a rich tapestry, once again, in the city of Detroit, a city that, once again, had a vibrant Black liberation movement, a vibrant labor movement, a vibrant religious movement. I mean, keep in mind that during the heyday of the Civil Rights Congress, which Paul Robeson worked with before that organization was liquidated, Paul Robeson, the great singer and actor and activist himself, was in and out of Detroit. And when he was in and out of Detroit, he was oftentimes supported by New Bethel Church, which came to be led by Reverend C.L. Franklin. This is the legacy that has been bequeathed to Aretha Franklin, which has now been bequeathed to the rest of us.
Reverend Dr. Keith William Byrd, Sr., pastor at the historic Zion Baptist Church in Northwest Washington, D.C. Reverend Byrd, thank you, sir. Dr. Gerald Horn, Moores, professor of history, University of Houston, author of numerous books. Dr. Horn, as always, man, you always answer when I call. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Over 350 U.S. newspapers devoted print space today to a coordinated defense of press freedom and a rebuke of President Donald Trump for saying some media organizations are enemies of the American people. So, kudos to the 350 newspapers who coordinated in defense of so-called press freedom. But is there actually a free press in this country? And is the free press in America doing its job? Let's turn to my next guests, writers and co-founders of Citizen Truth, Lauren von Bernuth and Oren Sharp. Welcome to the both of you to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate being on. That's a great question.
Before we get to discussing the free press, your thoughts on the president's attacks and the whole idea of fake news. This morning, the president tweeted that the fake news media are the opposition party, and we know that he has labeled the news media the enemy of the American people. So before we get to the free press question, your thoughts, let's start with Lauren, your thoughts on his attacks on the media.
Well, it's you know, we live in interesting times because we need the press. The press is vital to our country and to holding power accountable. But I think people are also coming to realize that a lot of our corporate press has a certain narrative that they want to pitch, and there's a bias. And so there is an element of the press isn't the enemy of the people, but there is an element of corporate press having a certain agenda. And I think that's something that people are just starting to wake up to and realize. But Trump is sort of using it to his advantage as a way to just refute any claims or anything made against him that he doesn't like.
Oren Sharp, same question to you before we get to discussing the issue of the free press. And do we have one? Your thoughts on the president's attacks on the media?
There's not a lot of things that I agree on with the president about. And when he's talking about fake news, I sort of agree with him on the attack on the fake news media agencies. Because when you talk about, let's say, CNN or Fox and what they've done over the years, for example, like the Iraq War, where they presented false evidence and, you know, they just basically launched this country into a war that they didn't need to go into. You know, millions of lives were lost, so a bunch of people were killed. And, you know, the press didn't do their job. They didn't hold power accountable like they should. And I'm just talking about corporate media. I'm not talking about, you know, independent media. But the corporate media, they're all following the same narrative about war, and they all agree on the same thing, whether it's the left or the right media press.
Lauren, Sarah the Huckster Sanders and other defenders of the president complain that very few outlets cover his positive stories, such as the job numbers and the economy. Is this a valid complaint? Because in my opinion, he just continues to feed the bear. I mean, he doesn't give you much space to talk about positive because he keeps stepping on his own story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not a fan of Trump, but I think one example could be with North Korea. And I wouldn't say the summit was hugely productive or anything, but I think that we should be supporting the idea of our leaders meeting with other heads of states to try to establish peace. And I don't think you heard, even if you disagree with that message, I just don't think you heard that idea or that message anywhere really in corporate media. You only got one viewpoint. And so I think, you know, for the most part, yeah, Trump kind of steps all over himself and so on. But there is certainly a tendency to, especially with war, to promote war and to not give him some credit for at least trying to establish peace and talk to North Korea.
And Oren, if you could follow up to that, and then let me just throw in, since Lauren was talking about war, I mentioned earlier Lockheed Martin awarded over $3 billion in contracts in just 2 days, and all of this to fight the Russian and Chinese boogeymen that Americans are being convinced, bombarded with, we've got to protect ourselves against China and Russia.
So, I mean, the press just has a talking point all the time. You know, they're always just agreeing on the same thing, which is just war. And, you know, I would actually like for them to actually focus on the facts instead of just, you know, warmongering or just scaring people into doing some, you know, scaring the country into doing something that, you know, they don't want to do. So the thing with Lockheed Martin, I rarely ever see anything about, you know, any of the mainstream news agencies talking about that deal. They didn't talk about how Trump, re-signed the National Defense Authorization Act. The only thing that they focused on was that he put John McCain on the NDAA bill. Mm-hmm. They don't care about what's actually in the NDAA bill. They just care about why he put John McCain on it or why he didn't give him enough credit. They didn't actually care about what's in the actual bill, which is way more important than John McCain's name on the bill. And, you know, when they just focus on little things like that, that doesn't really have much of an effect, or we don't really care about that. It just really upsets me whenever I just turn on the news.
So to the point at hand, 350 papers today coordinated their editorial pages to express disdain for Trump's attacks on the media. But is there, in fact, a free press in this country? Lauren?
I think in independent press, you'll find it. The corporate media, they do have a lot of resources that some independent media doesn't have. And obviously, Washington Post with Nixon and so on, they have done good things and good reporting. So you can't say that everything they do is, you know, biased and bad and so on. But
yeah, the Pentagon Papers.
Yeah, exactly. So
yeah, exactly.
I think the freest press you'll find is in independent media. And there's a lot of independent media outlets now that are really promoting a much more critical anti-war message. And they're doing, I mean, there's so many resources available online that it's incredible how much research people put into news now and these independent outlets. Because they also don't have the so-called legitimacy of saying they are the New York Times. So they have to put in a lot more work and research into what they're doing. And I mean, I've done a lot of research into the white helmets for so on, for example, and there's just a whole world of information out there that's not getting reported in mainstream news. So if you want a free press, I would go to independent news channels.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We talked about the Pentagon Papers. We talked about Watergate. But that just brings me up to Greg Palast and his research into the 2000 election and how Jeb Bush had hired the company Choice Point to scrub the voter lists in Florida. Choice Point found that the voter database was corrupt, sent the information to Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush said, just delete the corrupt columns and keep doing your work. And Greg has, I've seen on his computer, you know, he's got the database, and he could not get not one major American outlet to cover that story. So, Oren, I go to you with the same question. Do we, in fact, have a free press?
I think technically on paper we do, but there's systematic things put in place to prevent, you know, certain information from getting out there. For example, you know, that situation with Greg Palast, you know, if you try to go to the news agencies with like a big story that you think they should be covering, I wouldn't really hold my breath to, you know, expect them to actually, you know, do their diligence to actually get that news story out there. And, you know, this is kind of where we come in. I could say right now that, yeah, we do have free press, but, you know, there's also an attack on, you know, people like us. Because even though I did like Alex Jones recently, it kind of scares me a little bit that his site got taken down, because now I feel like we're kind of all on the chopping block now. They're going on after independent news agencies as well. So I think the window for free press, I think that window might be closing pretty soon. Hopefully it's not. I'm still optimistic that it won't.
So Lauren, Oren's point takes me to what was going to be my next question, talking about Alex Jones, talking about Facebook taking down the Telesaur page.
Mm-hmm.
So are we really seeing, and then as we know, there's a consolidation of media outlets in this country. So is it becoming harder and harder for the independent media to find its voice and find its space? And do you see what's happened with Alex Jones and what's happened to Telesaur being a bellwether for what's to come?
Mm-hmm. For sure. I know we talk with a lot of other independent news outlets, and they've taken major hits from, Google has all the power if you show up in a search engine ranking or not, and they get ranked as, they get lumped into this sort of fake news category. And it's unfortunate because it's not fake news. It's just an alternative viewpoint. And there's, with this whole Russian election scare, it's turned into an independent news McCarthyism as well, where everybody is accusing anybody that thinks of something different as fake news. I think, I'm a little bit torn with Alex Jones in particular, just because I feel like there is...
Just because it's Alex Jones.
I give him credit. He brings up some viewpoints and ideas that are that get people thinking and so on. But I know I would not want to be forced to print information that was hateful or violent or so on. But with Telstar, I don't think they were even told why they were taken down. And then these other independent sites I've talked to that have taken hits on their traffic, they're just printing, different viewpoints. I think The Intercept actually did an article where they were talking about the Israeli government was working with Facebook to take down a lot of Palestinian pages and so on. So where it gets scary is when the government is getting involved with these companies, these social media outlets, to make these decisions to take people down.
And that's what was going on behind the Facebook issue in terms of the entities that were working with Facebook to scrub these sites and take down the sites that they deemed to be, whose narrative was contrary to the established order. Let me say, Lauren, I know you've been doing a lot of work and investigation on the White House. I'd like to right now extend an invitation to you to come back next week and really explain to the audience who the White Hats are, who has been funding them, and they're not the altruistic, benevolent organization that they're being touted as.
Oh yeah, you mean the Syrian white helmets? Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So if you want to come on next week and talk about that, we'd love to have you on to do it.
Sure, I'd love to do it. Yeah.
Cool.
Lots to talk about there.
Great. Thank you so much.
Also, to follow up with that as well, I'm also doing a full-on documentary about ISIS and where they came from. And I was actually just talking about Lauren with this yesterday about when you talk about ISIS and then you go down this rabbit hole, the white helmets always pop up every single time. And then I went all the way back into the history, and I'm just doing a lot of research on that right now for a full-length video.
Well, then we got to have that conversation. We'll definitely get you both in on this. How can people contact you at Citizen Truth? Where do they go?
CitizenTruth.org. You can email me, Lauren@CitizenTruth.org. There's a contact form on there. We also welcome people to submit their articles. A big part of what we're doing is trying to get people to talk to each other. Doesn't matter if you're left or right. If you have a good, well-written article and you support it with facts, it's not hate speech. We let people publish, and then we try to get dialogue going. So come on, check us out.
All right. Oren Sharp, Lauren Von Bernuth. Did I get both names pronounced correctly?
You did. Thank you.
All right. I practiced. Hey, y'all. Thank you very much. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
All right, folks. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. Big shout out to my Facebook folks. Big shout out to my Facebook family. Thank you all. We're growing on Facebook. Keep listening. Keep watching. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. And you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Folks, there are two interesting stories regarding Steve Bannon. First, Bannon is mounting a last-ditch effort to save the House for Trump. He is attempting a political resurrection on two fronts. He's launching a 25-person pro-Trump rapid response and polling operation that is framing the midterms as an up or down vote on the president's impeachment. And second, he'll be an advisor to Brazilian presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro for the upcoming elections in October. According to Telser, the announcement was made by Bolsonaro's son and Congressman Eduardo Bolsonaro. So what does this mean for Bannon, and what does this say about the geopolitical landscape and the rise of alt-right politics? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a multimedia journalist who has contributed to a number of radio and television programs such as SiriusXM, WHUR 96.3, Ebony, Politic 365. He is the voice of reason, Ray Baker. Welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Dr. Leon, it's always good to be with you.
I've just given you a new moniker, man, the voice of reason.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And I think that in these days, a title like that is much needed. And so I'm grateful to wear it, and I'm grateful that you would bestow it upon me.
Well deserved, sir. First, the Bannon story regarding his launching this 25-person pro-Trump rapid response and polling operation is framed as a last-ditch effort to save the House. Is that an accurate description? Have the midterms become desperate for the Republicans so much so that a last-ditch effort is needed?
Absolutely. What we're seeing all across the nation are districts and various congressional races where Republicans, just the brand of Republicanism, is a referendum on Donald Trump. And every polling in the United States tells us that that referendum means something bad. So what Steve Bannon's doing here is largely trying to consolidate power for those who are of the wealthiest class who benefited the most with Donald Trump's election. An important thing for your listeners to consider, Dr. Leon, we talk so much about the culture wars, about the racism, about the sexism, about the homophobia that President Donald Trump has projected out into the United States. But the largest benefactors of a Trump administration has been the wealthy class of Americans. And so if there's sweeping change in the House, there's possibility that more of what Dr. Greg Carr calls the grifter-in-chief's policies will not go through. So, and we think about this, the important thing to consider about Bannon, he is not being funded by Robert Mercer this time, though he says there's no shortage of capital because rich people are going to lose out. So I am sure there are some rich people who would happily get behind Steve Bannon and what he's trying to do.
He is starting this Operation Citizens for the American Republic. And part of this is he's going back to his Hollywood producer hat, and he's putting together a documentary called Trump at War, which he plans to release in September. It's interesting that we're coming up on the midterm election. The president is not on the ballot, and a documentary is being designed, Trump at War. And this is some type of neo-civil war.
And he's releasing it on the anniversary of Secretary Clinton during the campaign calling the supporters of Donald Trump a basket of deplorables. So this Bannon operation is a very well thought out operation, and it plays to the worst in the American public. Again, there's two things to consider here. One, why is there an incentive to continue the metaphorical civil war of cultures? Why does that play so well on the American voting public? Why is that a measure that resonates with so many Americans across the country? And second, who stands to benefit? And when we examine both those things, we see the benefactors of Steve Bannon being successful on being largely rich white men.
So who do you think, you just mentioned rich white men, in terms of this Trump at War documentary, in terms of this Citizens for the American Republic, what is really the strategy here? Is it holding on to the base and trying to be sure that they get out the vote? Or is it trying to sway independents or undecideds? Because when we look at the numbers, and the numbers have been fairly consistent since he's been in the White House, folks seem to be pretty set in where they are and how they feel. So it doesn't really seem to me, again, looking at the numbers, he's got a 42% number that seems pretty solid. It doesn't seem as though that number is going to grow. So what do you think the strategy is here, holding the base or swaying new voters?
Dr. Leon, you're a political scientist, so I know you're on top of this all the way. And Donald Trump is the son the political atmosphere in the United States revolves around him. This in no way is attempting to sway anyone. At this stage of the Donald Trump game, so to speak, no one is learning new information. No one is like, you know, I'm okay with some of the racism. I'm not okay with some of the sexism. No one is having that dilemma. No one is having that conversation. So what this is doing, this is rallying the troops to say to those metaphorical troops, we need you. We need you to come out. We need you to show up. We need you to communicate to those who are like-minded as you to register to vote and then go vote. Because what we're seeing in a number of places, Democrats have made the decision, as you alluded to, that 42% is not moving. We are not seeing a cross-section of human beings who are going, I once stood with Donald Trump, and this is the bridge too far. What we're seeing, though, are Democrats are finding we may not convert people. We may register new people. And so the Republican pushback has to be, we have to ensure that whatever quantity of people that we do have, we do get them to the polls, because the polling that we have only accounts for registered and or likely voters. But if Democrats are effective and successful in, one, registering new voters, and two, turning out new voters, all of our polling models will be useless, and our polling models don't look good for us where we sit.
Now, I haven't done any research on this. This is just my own, I'll call it personal insight into these numbers. I've been saying for a while, I think his numbers are bigger than the polls are reflecting. And I have no idea how much bigger they are. But I think that there is a group of people in this country that when called on their phones by someone anonymously, they're not going to readily admit that they support Donald Trump.
The reverse Bradley effect, if you will.
There you go. I think there's I don't know if it's a point, 2 points, 5 points, but I think that there, to your point, the reverse Bradley effect from Los Angeles, I think that there is a contingent of people out there that are backing this guy but don't want to admit it.
And I think that's a reasonable conclusion. But I also would offer that whatever that number of the American voting public is, I don't, and this again, this is my conjecture, which given that you studied this in such ways that you have a PhD, I'm humbly offering is less than yours. I don't think that number ticks above 45%.
Okay.
So, and what many Republicans are finding out are that because they've decided to cast their lot as the party for white people, right? The party that is explicitly for white people. When we're finding new demographics of Americans, whether we're talking about Asian Americans, African Americans, or Hispanic Americans, we're finding those folks that are registering, and more often than not, registering Democrats. So what Republicans, they're not going to get a new audience of voters. So what they have to do is super serve that demo, double down on the things they find to be effective in order to turn them out. That's what we see with Steve Bannon. That's what we see with him campaigning. I mean, this film and Steve Bannon's Hollywood efforts, if you will, are nothing but a propaganda machine on steroids. And what they're trying to do is trying to galvanize that group that often finds themselves as members of a victimized, oppressed community, which there's such, the irony is so thick, you can kiss your fingertips and let them go into the air as the best chef in the world. But they find themselves as victims and often oppressed. What this film will actually entail is scenes of what he called the violent liberal left beating up Trump supporters. Right. And so meanwhile, we know ostensibly the violence perpetrated on people in the United States are largely done by those who would ascribe themselves as right wing. We also know that the domestic terrorism that was the Ku Klux Klan knows no party. It just knows a wing, so to speak. But that's beyond the point regarding Steve Bannon's piece. What's going to be most important to consider here, though, is that there is no new ground necessarily for Republicans to try to bring in new people because they're not speaking with a message of inclusiveness in any way. And again, right. This is not to praise Democrats in any noble way to say that they offer a better platform that speaks to sincere inclusiveness. This is just to say Democrats get to stand to the side and go, we're not them.
I want to quickly move over to Brazil because I just found that I found it incredibly interesting that Bannon would be advising Brazilian presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro seems to have a lot of traits that are similar to Trump. Bolsonaro basically seems to be a racist. In a country that has, I think, the second largest group of Africans outside of the continent, he says that they don't owe black Brazilians anything. And he's talking about doing away with affirmative action and all kinds of other progressive programs in Brazil. And so it seems as though Steve Bannon is on board with Jair Bolsonaro. So here's the question. If Bannon plays a role in the right holding the House in this country, and Bannon is successful in Bolsonaro's run in October in Brazil, man, that's a dangerous, dangerous formula for neo-fascism and ultra-right politics on the geopolitical landscape.
Absolutely it is. And we would be remiss to discuss Brazilian politics and not mention the name of our dear sister, Mariel Franco, who was assassinated. And meanwhile, while calling out police violence, Dr. Leon, I don't know if your listeners know, but I live in Baltimore, and many of your listeners may have seen recently video that circulated around the internet of a Baltimore police officer brutally beating that he was having a conversation with. And Mariel Franco mentioned that. So to your point about what this means for global hegemony of fascism, of course it means that. And I think we would be wise to, as the old adage says, follow the money. Who's funding Steve Bannon this time? If it's not Robert Mercer, who is funding him? And for what end are they funding him, right? What are the benefits? What are the geopolitical benefits? What are the global capitalist class benefits that someone could reap from a Trump victory and then from a Bolsonaro victory? Where's the outcome here? What's the end game? And I think if we follow the money, we'll find some nefarious things that we, the working people, we, the class, we, the proletariat, we who care about justice and fairness would be utterly displeased.
And folks that are listening to this, particularly those that are based here in the United States, you can't lose sight of what's going on in Brazil. You can't lose sight of what's going on in Nicaragua. You can't lose sight of what's going on in Venezuela, because the politics and the interests that are undermining those populist, left-leaning socialist governments in those countries, the folks that are opposing those interests are the same people that are oppressing you here. They're the same interests. That's what drove me to put this together and to call upon you to provide some insight in terms of Steve Bannon. It's not an accident that Steve Bannon is playing in the politics in Brazil and Steve Bannon is back in the game here.
Right, right. It's not an accident. And I think the confluence of race and class cannot be
overlooked. It can't be dismissed. It can't be overlooked. Ray Baker, man, thank you so much as always. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. Looking forward to getting you back on the Critical Hour.
Yes, sir. Glad to be here with you.
Thanks, man. Again, folks, it's the same interests. The same interests. It's not an accident that Steve Bannon is playing in the politics in Brazil with a candidate whose profile is almost a mirror image of Donald Trump. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all tomorrow right here on Radio Sputnik. Again, big shout out to my Facebook fans, my Facebook family. Thank you all very much. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.